All right, so this evening we will be in Deuteronomy chapters 24, and my hope is that we will sneak into chapter 25. We will spend most of the evening, I think, talking about Moses' extended commentary on the Eighth Commandment, but we're going to begin in Deuteronomy chapter 24 in verse 1, finishing up here with the seventh commandment. So the seventh commandment, of course, is you shall not commit adultery, from Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 18. And we see here in the first four verses the following. Moses speaking to this second generation of Israelites on the east side of the Jordan River, near the end of his life. Moses says this to Israel: "When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance." All right, so very interesting law here. Let's see, so a few things to say. So the first thing I would say is that we saw back in Leviticus 21, verse 7, as we were talking about the holiness of the priests, that it was mentioned there that the priests were not allowed to marry a divorced woman. And so it was hinted at even as far back in the holiness code of Leviticus, the latter portion of Leviticus, that divorce was a thing in Israel. And so here in Deuteronomy chapter 24, we see a couple of different things. We see the process for divorce, and we also see the law regarding divorce. And the law really is found in verse 4. This idea that if husband number 1 gives his wife a certificate of divorce, and then she goes off and marries another man, then she is never allowed to return to that original husband. That really is the essence of the law that we're given here in the first few verses of Deuteronomy chapter 24. So I want to point out a couple of things from the text. So in verse 1, you see that there is actually a process here. And the process, as we have been saying over and over again in this study, the process itself is part of the deterrent. So we know, of course, and I'll get to this in a more extended way, but we know from Matthew 19 and Mark chapter 10, and of course Genesis chapter 1, that this was not God's original design for marriage, this idea that a husband and wife would divorce. And so we see here a couple of things that provide deterrence, or at least are designed to be deterrence, here in Deuteronomy 24. So the first one is that there's actually a certificate of divorce that is needed. And so the assumption here is that the man, he cannot simply walk out into the town square and make an announcement with his mouth. He actually has to go and he has to write down what it is that he finds indecent about his wife. And so that's the first part of the process. And I think it's also probably true here, I would agree with the commentaries here, that this idea of the certificate of divorce most likely lends itself to the fact that that certificate would be a formal document that would also have to come to the elders of the city, for example. So there would have to be some sort of public proclamation of this. And then we also see in verse 1, as part of the process, which is also part of the deterrence, is that this man, he has to take this certificate of divorce that has perhaps gone through the elders of the town, and he has to put it in the hand of the woman. So he has to look her in the eye and declares that he no longer wants to be her husband, and he no longer wants her to be his wife, and he has to send her out of his house. And some of the commentaries even note, perhaps from some extra biblical Jewish writings, that there would not only be a certificate of divorce, but this idea of putting this certificate in her hand would mean that she would also have to be compensated by the man in some way for this certificate of divorce. That would be monetarily, to ensure that she could at least survive for a time before she found another husband. And we see that in verse 2. She leaves the first husband's house and she goes and becomes another man's wife. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then she cannot return to the former husband. And so even that aspect of the law itself is also, I believe, serving as a deterrent here. This idea that a man should not make a rash decision. So, you know, oftentimes, if there's, let's say, a spirited debate between a husband and a wife, for example, and that goes on for a few days, and then there's a reconciliation. And so this forbiddance of the wife to return to her husband as part of the law in verse 4 there is also, I believe, serving as a deterrent, that a husband should not make a rash decision to put away his wife, especially the wife of his youth, whom he at least at one time loved. So, with all of these deterrents in place, I do believe that it's clear from the text that this is not supposed to be a trivial offense. Okay? It's obviously not adultery, right? Because adultery is something that is paid for, by death of the woman if she would have committed adultery. And in fact, if you go back to Numbers 5, even if she were suspected of adultery, there's a process there in Numbers chapter 5 to see whether or not the woman was in fact guilty of adultery. Nonetheless, I do think this is not something to be trivialized. And there were a couple of schools in Jewish history that disagreed about what the level of the triviality or the level of the indecency had to be. Now, some schools, for example, the school of Hillel, if I remember correctly, they were willing to allow a man to divorce his wife for something very, very, very small. Something like, even I read in one commentary, bad breath, for example. And then there was another school of Shammai who raised the bar substantially. And so even in Jewish history around the time of Jesus, there were differences of opinion as to what level of indecency would justify, say, the elders of a city to grant the certificate of divorce. And of course, if you turn with me to Matthew chapter 19, it is most likely this debate among the teachers in Israel that is the root of the question in the early portion of Matthew chapter 19. So we see in Matthew 19, and it came about that when Jesus had finished these words, the words, of course, in chapter 18, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. Verse 3, and some Pharisees came to him, testing him, and saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? And so this question would have had in its background the school of Hillel. Right? And so they want to see where Jesus falls, right? Because again, they're trying to trap Jesus, they're testing Jesus, and they're trying to form an opinion against Jesus. And so they figure, well, if we ask him this question, then at least we can divide two of the great schools of thought here against Jesus. One would be for and one would be against, but either way, he is stuck when we ask him this question. Of course, our Lord Jesus, he is they try to trap him many different times, and it turns out that he actually never gets trapped because he always provides the right and profound answer. In verse 4 of Matthew 19, he, Jesus, answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate.'" And so they think that Jesus is going to go back to Deuteronomy 24 and give some interpretation of Deuteronomy chapter 24. But in fact, Jesus does not go back to Deuteronomy 24. He goes all the way back to Genesis 1 and 2 and establishes what God established from the very beginning. And so he circumvents the question. Of course, they press him. Verse 7, they, the Pharisees, said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away?" So they're now going to force him to exegete, as it were, Deuteronomy 24 verses 1 to 4. Verse 8, Jesus says to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way." And so you can see in verse 7 that the Pharisees press on Jesus, and they use the word command there, and they misquote Deuteronomy chapter 24 verse 1. Moses did not command any Jewish man to divorce his wife. Jesus correctly interprets Deuteronomy chapter 24 verse 1 by using the word permitted. It is definitely a different Greek word, permitted, in verse 8 of Matthew chapter 19, and that is the right interpretation of Deuteronomy chapter 24 verse 1, but he emphasizes again at the end of verse 8, "But from the beginning it has not been this way." And so we see that, and we've seen this before, right? We see that Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, there's a certain level of permissiveness in the way that he deals with his old covenant people, Israel, right? We saw that previously from Deuteronomy chapter 17, and that the fact that the kings should not multiply wives for themselves, and yet God allows David, for example, to have multiple wives. And so we see, again, this level of permissiveness, and there's probably a much longer conversation to be had on that subject again, but we've had that before a little bit, and so I don't want to do that again here. And it probably has to do with Paul talking about in Romans 3, God passing over sins previously committed. So anyway, that is Deuteronomy 24, the law about divorce, and Jesus's exegesis of it. Of course, he establishes the permanency of marriage in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. In verse 5, Moses says, "When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army, nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken." And so we saw this a couple of chapters ago in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 7. So this is not a new law, but it here finishes up, at least for now, this discussion of the seventh commandment and laws regarding marriage. So, as we move on to verse 6 of Deuteronomy chapter 24, we're going to, for the most part, spend the rest of our time together tonight, talk about Moses' extended commentary on the eighth commandment, except for a couple of verses here later in Deuteronomy 24. So let me pick up in verse 6. "No one shall take a handmill or an upper millstone in pledge, for he would be taking a life in pledge." So here, again, the eighth commandment is, you shall not steal. We see that in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 19. So we're going to talk about and the extended commentary on you shall not steal. So here in verse 6, we have this idea that if someone takes a handmill or an upper millstone, it says you would be taking a life in pledge. And so essentially, if someone owes you something, one thing that the Israelites were not allowed to do is they were not allowed to take the means by which they fed their family or produced their livelihood. So this could be a personal millstone or handmill by which they would be able to crush grain and make bread. Or this could in fact be a millstone that produced a livelihood as part of a business on behalf of the Israelite. And so what you're doing here is you're not only taking food and money out of the mouth and hands of an Israelite, but you're also taking away that Israelite's capability to pay back the debt that he owes. And so you are completely hamstringing now your fellow Israelite by taking this means by which perhaps the Israelite is making money and can pay back his debt. And so Israelites are not supposed to do that. Verse 7. If a man is caught kidnapping any of his countrymen of the sons of Israel, and he deals with him violently or sells him, then that thief shall die. So shall you purge the evil from among you. And so here we see man stealing, right? And so kidnapping is a heinous offense in Israel, and it is a capital offense punishable by death. Now, brief aside, verses 8 and 9. Moses says this, "Be careful against an infection of leprosy, that you diligently observe and do according to all that the Levitical priests shall teach you, as I have commanded them, so you shall be careful to do. Remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way as you came out of Egypt." So these two verses, I racked my brain and scoured the commentaries for how these might be a commentary on the Eighth Commandment. And I just can't get there. So it seems to me that Moses throws this in there as more of a commentary on the fifth commandment, right? To honor your father and mother. If you remember when we talked about that a few sessions ago, honor your father and mother was a shorthand command for honoring authority. And if you remember the story back in Numbers chapter 12, Miriam was challenging the authority of Moses and ended up with leprosy in that part of the narrative. And those rules that Moses gave to the Levitical priests, for your reference, with regard to if an Israelite gets some sort of skin disease like leprosy, those rules, we discussed those back when we were in Leviticus chapters 13 and 14. So that would be for your reference. Okay, verse 10, back to the eighth commandment. "When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house to take his pledge. You shall remain outside, and the man to whom you make the loan shall bring the pledge out to you. And if he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. When the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him, that he may sleep in his cloak and bless you, and it will be righteousness for you before the Lord your God." Right? And so this idea is that when there's a loan made between Israelites, the Israelite who makes the loan should not enter the house of his brother. That is, his brother is the one who is taking out the loan is the one who decides what the collateral shall be for the payment of the loan. And of course, you know, this is a sign of respect. You should not steal the dignity of your brother, in a sense, because you might walk into his house and you might decide that you would like something else that's more valuable as collateral. And so God does not give the Israelites the right to do that. And this is evidence of gracious lending practices in Israel, especially among Israelite brothers, right? So I would say that God would say to the Israelites, yes, you may loan to your brothers, but you should not lord it over your brothers. And we see that again in verses 12 and 13. And if he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. When the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him, right? And so this, if he's a poor man, perhaps the only thing that he owns is his tunic. And so it would be ungracious, at least unkind, and worse even, to leave a poor man in his home without a covering as he freezes during the night. And so again, it is okay to loan to your brother, but it is not okay to lord it over your brother. And in any lending situation, the Israelites are commanded and expected to be gracious to one another. Verse 14, "You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens who is in your land, in your towns. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he may not cry against you to the Lord and it becomes sin in you." And so here we have not paying a day laborer his day wages is stealing from a worker. right? He's living hand to mouth. He's living day to day. He is poor and needy, verse 14, and this would be stealing in order not to give him his payment, that he might go into the square and buy his wheat, that he might make bread for himself and for his family. So the wages, remember, wages are owed to a worker, and they must be paid, else the employer is stealing from the employee. And so we see that under the eighth commandment as well. And James actually quotes this particular verse in James chapter 5, verse 4, about not paying a man his wages for the work that is done. And it's of course, James is pounding on the law in his epistle, and he does not take too kindly to someone who violates this particular law in Deuteronomy chapter 24. Verse 16, fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. And so this law here, right, it preserves a person's individualism. Right? So this would be stealing a father's life, for example, for the sins of his son. And so this is an important precept in Israel. For a good example of this, you might go to 2 Kings chapter 14, but extremely important that this particular precept preserves the individualism of each of the Israelites as they live their lives. Verse 17, you shall not pervert the justice due an alien or an orphan, nor take a widow's garment in pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. So there's a little bit of the ninth commandment here in verse 17, which we will pick up on the next time we're together, Lord willing, this idea of perverting justice. But we see, again, at the end of verse 17, this idea of taking a widow's garment in pledge, right? Again, that may be the only thing of value that she has, and so to take a widow's garment in pledge would be a form of stealing in Israel, not the least of which stealing would be stealing a widow's dignity as well. And so, and the purpose of this particular law in verse 17 is given in verse 18. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. And so we see, do not pervert justice due an alien or an orphan. That is, you should be treating others in a manner opposite to the way that you were treated, and to this second generation of Israelites, that your parents were treated in Egypt. And so I think this is primarily related to the alien that's mentioned earlier in verse 17. And then verses 19 through 22 of Deuteronomy 24. When you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. And when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. So here we have this idea that they should not be harvesting all the way to the ends of their fields, or going back over and picking up the things that they left behind. In essence, this would be the Israelites stealing from the poor. Stealing from the poor. That's how this fits under the eighth commandment. This idea, remember, God owns everything in the land. It is not primarily the Israelites' property or even harvest. God owns everything, and God has reserved a certain portion of the things that he allows to grow in the land of Canaan for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. And so this would be stealing from the poor if the Israelites were to be greedy and go back through their fields. And I just want to emphasize here that this It says three times in verses 19, 20, and 21. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. And so the aliens and the orphans and the widows are apparently very important to the Lord. And you can see echoes of that in the epistle to of James as well in the New Testament as to what true religion is, caring for the orphans and for the widows. And so it's something that we should give thought to as we are caring for others, caring especially for those who are most needy in our midst. All right, chapter 25, verse 1. If there's a dispute between men, and they go to court, and the judges decide their case, and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall then make him lie down and be beaten in his presence with the number of stripes according to his guilt. He may beat him 40 times, but no more, lest he beat him with many more stripes than these, and your brother be degraded in your eyes. Okay, and so what we see here is a window into what punishment looked like in Israel that was short of capital punishment. Okay, so this is punishment short of capital punishment. I would note here that there were no jails in Israel. Right, that these payments were to be made upon the rendering of justice. You can see that in verse 1. The judges decide their case and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten. And this law is probably running in the background of Jesus' discussion in Luke chapter 12 when he's talking about the punishments of the unrighteous. Luke chapter 12, verses 47 and 48. This is something that the Israelites would have seen many times. And in verse 3, you can see that the limit was placed at 40 times. And there's a couple of comments here. So first of all, I would note that Paul mentions this in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, that he had received 39 lashes multiple times. And so Paul was certainly familiar with this particular law as he was on the receiving end of it from the Jews on multiple occasions. And the reason why 39 is listed there by Paul and not 40, there's a couple of comments in the commentaries about this. It could be that they would stop at 39 just in case they had miscounted and they did not want to go beyond the law of God and make a mistake and make it 41. It could also mean that what they were using, the instrument that they were using for the beatings, might have had three prongs on it. And so this would be 13 shots times three prongs. And of course, the 14th shot would take you all the way to 42. There's a couple of different comments as to why Paul would have received 39 and not the 40. So how does this fit into the eighth commandment? Well, it's there at the end of verse 3. You can see, and your brother be degraded in your eyes, were he to receive more than 40 lashes. This is justice that does not steal a man's dignity. Justice that does not steal a man's dignity. He certainly, according to justice, is due punishment, but not punishment so as to degrade that Israelite in the sight of the rest of Israel. Verse 4, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. This is such an interesting verse. It's actually quoted twice in the New Testament. It's quoted in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 9. It's also quoted by Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 18. And so what's the issue here? The issue is that the muzzle being placed on an ox as he's threshing out the grain, which would prevent him from eating while he's working, is in fact stealing from the ox itself. The ox is the one who is working, and so the ox deserves to eat. And so if you muzzle the ox and do not allow him to eat, then you are in fact stealing something from him, his wages that he deserves. In both cases in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 9 and 1 Timothy 5, Paul uses this verse to justify the support of the pastors and itinerant preachers, as Paul was. And so he looks at this verse and basically argues that those who make their who spend their life's work for the gospel deserve their wages from the gospel. And so he makes that argument a couple of different places in the New Testament. Verse 5. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, "I do not desire to take her," then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, "Thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house." And in Israel his name shall be called the house of whom whose sandal is removed. All right, so this is the law of levirate marriage. Right. Again, the key here is that you have an Israelite, and he dies, verse 5, and has no son. He has no heir. Then the wife of that man, who has presumably obviously not given him an heir, right, she is to go to the Israelite's brother and demand that the brother provide the deceased brother with an heir, with a son. So what's the issue here? The issue in the with respect to the eighth commandment is that that if that man who died without a son, without an heir, right, that man would lose, he would lose the property given to him in Israel, because that property would necessarily have gone to his son, his heir. And so in essence, what's happening here is that the brother who is alive, who is commanded to perform this act with the dead man's wife, if he does not perform this act, he is actually attempting to steal the property and to steal the heritage of his dead brother in Israel. And you can see that in verse 6. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. So that property, and again, personal and private property, is an extremely important idea in the Mosaic law. And so this idea of levirate marriage is here so that a man's name is not blotted out from Israel, and that his property, which was granted to him by God, is not stolen from him, but in fact passes to his heir, his son. And so this is extremely important. And we can see that it's extremely important because of what's happening in verses 7 through 10. I mean, this is obviously a serious offense. The brother's wife, if the deceased brother's wife, right, she has a responsibility because of her husband's honor. That's really important to understand. Because of her deceased husband's honor, she has a responsibility in Israel to demand this from her brother-in-law. And if her brother-in-law refuses, for whatever reason, it doesn't matter, she is then to go to the elders, to the gate of the city, to the elders, and say, "My husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." And so then the elders, here in verse 8, we see they summon the brother to the city gate, and they speak to him, they plead with him. You can see they're pleading with him because if he persists, verse 8, and says, "I do not desire to take her," right? Then we have this other act of shame in the direction of the brother himself, where the wife is to take his sandal off of his foot and to spit in his face. The New American Standard Version says it may just be spit at his feet, but spit sort of before his face, which for a woman to do is clearly an act of shame directed at the brother here. And then he gets a name in verse 10. He gets a name, the house of him whose sandal is removed. And so this concept of levirate marriage, it seems obviously distant and foreign to us. But in the context of Old Covenant Israel, we see that this raising up of sons, raising up of heirs in an honor-based system where the primary piece that a person owned is the property that God had given to them in the land of Canaan as a promise, the promise that he made to Abraham. This is an extremely serious deal. And in fact, there are echoes of this in Ruth chapter 4 as well. You can, if you remember, you like to go there in Ruth 4, there's a transaction at the gate of the city where a man's sandal is removed as well. And so that is a relatively gentle example of this, of a man who chooses not to take Ruth as his wife. But that story there with Boaz, still you can see this at the city gate that one of the men takes off his sandal and there's a contract made there, and Boaz ends up marrying Ruth the Moabitess. So anyway, very interesting portion here on levirate marriage. All right, finally, verses 11 and 12. If two men, a man and his countryman, are struggling together, and the wife of one comes near to deliver her husband from the hand of the one who is striking him, and puts out her hand and seizes his genitals, then you shall cut off her hand, you shall not show pity. So, very interesting law here. But again, in the context of the Eighth Commandment, what we see here is a woman who apparently has no shame, and she's attempting to steal the dignity of her husband's rival. And again, we see this being an extremely serious offense. You shall cut off her hand. You shall not show pity. And it may very well be that Jesus has this law in his mind in Matthew chapter 5, verse 30, and elsewhere, where he talks about gouging out eyes and cutting off hands. Deuteronomy 24, beginning in verse 6 through Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 12, Moses' extended commentary on the eighth commandment, you shall not steal. And Lord willing, again, as we come back and pick up in Deuteronomy 25, we'll see some commentary on the ninth commandment, you shall not bear false witness.